Thank you. So this work is not about LIGO. And in the time we have till the next science run, so that gives us a chance to do other things, not just looking at data. Still, I'm going to introduce this talk by looking at a particular LIGO result. So let me explain this very slowly. So this was for the very first binary black hole detection. That's 150914, doesn't really matter. The important point is to think of this like two comparable mass black holes which merge from a common horizon, and then the horizon settles down to form a Kerr black hole at the end. So this is a plot from one of the analyses that we did for the what I'm going to call the post-merger phase for this event. And so what is done here is that you look at the waveform signal that we see in LIGO, look at the point where it's a maximum, and then from that point onwards, you try to fit a damp sinusoid to the signal, right? So the motivation being that at this stage, when the black hole is formed, it's going to approach a Kerr black hole. At some point, it's going to be a perturbation of a Kerr black hole. And then at that point, what you expect in the waveform is a damp sinusoid, with frequency and damping time being precisely what you expect from for a Kerr black hole. So then the question is, at what point in time after the merger can the black hole be represented by a perturbed Kerr black hole? So what is done here is the following. So the time here, this 1 millisecond, 3, 5, and 7, this refers to time just after the peak of the signal seen by LIGO Hanford. So what you do here is that you start by fitting a damp sinusoid to the signal just 1 millisecond, just after the peak of the waveform. And then from the waveform, then you extract what the distribution is for the decay time and for the frequency of the best fit of waveforms. And then you see that as we change the 1 millisecond to 3 millisecond, so the best fit point in the decay time and the frequency that moves. So this tells us that at this stage, the black hole is not in equilibrium. So at this stage, if I want to measure the frequency and damping time, so this has not reached equilibrium yet. At some point, which is 5 milliseconds, then the error bars become larger and larger because I'm seeing less and less of the waveform. So fewer cycles, so larger error bars. So that's why these distributions become more and more broader as I go to later times. Still, after this time onwards, the error bars sort of grow, but they don't shift in frequency and damping time. Okay? So this is indication that somewhere between 3 and 5 milliseconds, the black hole has essentially reached what I would call a perturbed Kerr situation. And after that point, then it is slowly damping down and becoming and reaching reaching equilibrium. This is not important. I'm not going to talk about that. So the important thing I want to convey is that roughly 5 milliseconds after the peak of the waveform, at least from this very simple analysis, it indicates that at this point, the black hole has reached equilibrium. Okay, or it's a perturbed Kerr black hole at that stage. And if I were to convert this 5 milliseconds into geometric units, taking total solar mass of the system, 70 solar masses, you get roughly 15 m in geometric units. So this was great. This was, okay, this is admittedly large error bars and everything, but the first time you can do this observationally and with the data set that you see in an experiment. You can also do similar things with numerical waveforms. So you can take waveforms generated by numerical simulation, start with two black holes of different masses, and then you ask a similar question. And these people did the analysis in 2012. So what they did was they looked at the frequency evolution of the signal, instantaneous frequency evolution, and they saw at what point are the different modes of the signal consistent with the different modes of the ring down for a Kerr black hole. And what they found was that roughly 10 m after the peak of the luminosity, not the waveform itself, is when the frequencies match. Okay. So this analysis is roughly consistent with the other one. So again, the times are different. But again, the peak of luminosity is not the same as the peak of the waveform. But anyway, so it's roughly a similar result here. And the question I want to ask in this talk is, can we see similar effect at black hole horizons? So all of these are questions you ask for the waveform, which is really far away from the black hole. And the question is, assuming that we have standard GR, no strange things happening at the horizon, what would we see at the black hole horizon? And can we see a similar effect at the horizon itself? Yeah.
What is M?
M is the total mass of the system.
Masses are around 30 solar masses.
Yeah, so it's 35 roughly, so.
But this is the mass of the final black hole?
No, this is a sum of the initial masses.
So the initial masses?
Yeah, not the final mass. That's lesser than this.
30 solar masses total.
It's the total mass that it started off with, the whole system.
Just your geometric units.
Sorry, I didn't get that?
So 15 M in geometric units.
Exactly. So M is a total mass. That's 70 solar masses. So essentially, as we'll see, what the mass scale is set by the ADM mass of the spacetime we're looking at. And then if I take G times M upon C square will give me a length, and G times M upon C cube will give me a time. So that's basically what this time refers to here. All right, so then these are the questions I want to answer in this talk. So the zeroth order question is, how do black hole horizons behave during a black hole merger? How does the area of the horizons increase? And what is the infalling flux of gravitational waves? And is there a correlation between what's falling into the black hole and what's going out to infinity? And then, in more quantitatively, at what rate does the final black hole shed its moment and approach a Kerr solution? And then finally, as we just saw for the BBH event, is there a time after which we can think of the black hole as a linear perturbation of Kerr? And as you'll see, I don't have definitive answers to all of these questions, but hopefully there's an idea of where we're going with this. So before I go into the main topic, I need to sort of get you away from event horizons, because that's not what we will be doing in the talk. So that's not in numerical simulations, it's actually quite cumbersome to locate event horizons, and it's also not what we want to do. So to motivate this, let me first give you something that you've seen almost surely in GR, so which is the standard conformal diagram for a Schwarzschild black hole. And here we have here the singularities. This is the event horizon at r equal to 2m. This is the exterior spacetime that we all live in, and that's irrelevant for our purposes. And the point is that an observer somewhere here is causally disconnected from anything that happens inside here. And so this r equal to 2m surface is then the event horizon. And almost all the results of black hole physics, they use event horizons, and typically because they refer to the Kerr or Schwarzschild or simple situations. There's the one result, which is the singularity theorem, which does not rely on that, which in fact applies to a very general initial data. So that says uses what I call a closed trap surface. And so the theorem is essentially that if you have a closed trap surface, which I'll define in a moment, then you have a singularity in your spacetime. And these trap surfaces are really what we're going to use to understand black holes in the numerical simulations that I'm going to talk about. And now to explain what a closed trap surface is, I need to define for you at least two quantities of interest here. The first is the expansion. So now imagine a bunch of light rays which are propagating in spacetime. And look at a small area element spanned by the light rays. The expansion is the rate at which the area of this cross-section increases. The shear is a transformation which preserves the area. It just shears the circle into this form. And a twist is something that's like vorticity in the situation. But that's not going to be important for us. What is important will be expansion and the shear of light rays. So the expansion is the rate of change of the area, and the shear is, again, deformation like this. So now let's define what we mean by closed trap surface. So I'll always talk about spherical topology. So you have a sphere in your spacetime, and then given a sphere, and assuming that this is a space-like surface, then you can define the in and outgoing null normals, call them L for the outgoing one and N for the ingoing one. For a trap surface, both of these have to be negative. So if I go back to the Schwarzschild spacetime here, so a sphere at this point with L and N, so both of these are negative expansion. The expansion of a sphere at the horizon is zero for the outgoing direction and negative for the ingoing one, and a sphere here will have positive expansion for both directions.
So how do you decide which direction is in and which direction is out?
You got to choose that. So here I've always chosen this to be the outward outgoing direction here.
Yeah, two merging black hole situation. I don't know, it sounds complicated, so I don't know how to that's like a coordinate dependent statement.
You got to make a choice, but there is, so what happens is that this is sort of an artificial thing. This is not really what we have in astrophysics.
Right.
So in the white hole region also. So typically, all you think about is I got a black hole situation. We have observers far away who are observing it. Any direction from the system to the observer is the outgoing direction.
You mean the geodesic direction? I'm just imagining like a point in between the two black holes. It would be inwards towards one of the black holes and outwards from the other black hole.
No, no, no. So these are points. So you got to think about the black hole itself, and the black hole horizon, it separates the space-time into two regions. One is inside, one is outside. And the outside there is defined to be the place where the observers live, far away.
Right. But of course, if you have two black holes and have two of these, and then when they get close to each other, that's what I was thinking is
right, so the so this is referring to a single black hole now.
Right.
So for each of the black hole, there's an inside and outside. And the outside is where the observers are. And of course, the other black hole is outside the other black hole.
Yeah.
So black hole 2 is outside the first black hole, right? So in that sense, it depends on which black hole you're talking about.
But the outside that you're referring to is the whole space-time outside.
Yeah, so
outside.
Yeah, so imagine again you have two black holes.
Oh, so it is a space.
And then, yeah, your observers are somewhere here, far away. So if I'm somewhere in here, then any direction, or well, observers are all around it, okay? So
you're imagining a section, a spatial section of the...
Yeah, if you wish, yes.
And your answer will depend on the choice of a spatial section, do you think? Or...
It will. The answers will depend on... What I'm going to talk about will depend upon... well, strictly speaking, they will, but really, they don't.
Okay.
But inside, outside, I mean, that is quite clear.
Charlie.
Yeah.
The event horizons formulated for the null future.
Indeed, yes. So I'll talk about that in a minute.
Outside of surface concern.
Yes, indeed. So I'm just referring now to the simple Schwarzschild case, but exactly for the point that you said, I'll come to that in a minute. But let me just finish these definitions, because we will need them in a few minutes. So the important definition for us is what is called the outer trap surface, where the outgoing expansion is zero, and there is no condition on the ingoing one. And again, the presence of surfaces like this is telling you that black holes are present, but doesn't mean that you have strong gravitational field in the sense of tidal forces. So in the sense that you have the tidal forces like m upon r cubed, and that could be small for a large black hole, but even then you do have these surfaces present. The important ones for us are what are called the marginally trapped surfaces, so in which one is zero and the ingoing one is negative. And marginally outer trap means just that, well, that's the same definition. And then we come to a spatial slice, and that is where we have a definition of what is called an apparent horizon. So what that means is that if I have a particular spatial slice, and I draw it like this, and if I have a region here containing trapped surfaces, the outermost one is then what is called the apparent horizon. Of course, if you have two black holes, then there's two apparent horizons. And what that means is that if you deform the horizon outwards, that becomes untrapped for each of them. Okay? Right, I'm not going to talk about this here. But I want to give an example in which shows clearly why event horizons will not be useful for what I'm going to talk about. And it's a toy model, so it's not really meant to be realistic, but just as to talk about these concepts. So the solution is called the Vaidya solutions, and it's a really simple one. If you look at Schwarzschild in Edna Fickle sign coordinates, ingoing ones, and you switch your m to be not a constant, but a function of the coordinate v, then you got a stress energy tensor, which is null dust. It depends upon m dot, and then, this is then the null direction. And then, so this represents collapse of spherically symmetric null dust, which is falling in and forming a black hole. And then we can look at event horizons in this very simple spacetime. So this is a particular situation in which I have no infalling null dust in this blue region here. So this is just flat space. Starting from here, I have infalling null dust, which falls and then shuts off at this point here. And after this, I have Schwarzschild. Okay. In between, what would be the r equal to 2m surface that looks like this? And if I were to trace the event horizon back, I would get a surface like this here. Okay? So essentially, I go all the way to the end, trace back the last null ray that can go outwards, and then I get this null surface. And then imagine that you have an observer who's living here. There is no black hole. It's really flat space. But then there's an event horizon in this region, which is growing, even though there's nothing falling into the black hole. Okay? So this shows you that for an event horizon, there cannot be, in principle, a general expression for the flux of infalling radiation, which tells you that it is growing as matter falls in, because everyone will agree there is no matter, nothing falling into the black hole here.
You're doomed without knowing it.
You're not doomed at all. Everything is fine. This is just flat space. You live out your whole life and you'll never know you're inside an event horizon. Yes.
No, I mean in the future.
Well, everybody dies in the future at some point, right? Everybody dies. So that doesn't... That's okay. And to make it worse, you can think of a situation where I have null dust falling in this region, shutting off and then falling again. So an observer here will happily think there's an event horizon here. So he might look at stars orbiting the black hole, and he'll find, oh, there's some central object here. So I have stars orbiting this black hole in this region. But he or she doesn't know that something else is going to happen in the future, and he might well be inside the actual event horizon that is this surface here.
It takes an infinite amount of time for the event horizon to fall.
Exactly. So essentially what I'm trying to say is that event horizons are useless for this, for what we want to do here. So what are more useful are these marginally trapped surfaces. So now people call them apparent horizons, which is sort of not a nice thing to say. They're apparent, so they're not real, right? On the other hand, they do have very nice mathematical properties. So this is one which will be useful for us. So imagine I've done a 3+1 split of space-time. So I located an apparent horizon. Let's call it this one here. And then I evolve this in time. Okay? So now you can show, in a precise mathematical sense, you can prove a theorem saying that if a particular condition is satisfied, then the evolution is smooth. All right? So, but before that, let me make one more definition, which is that imagine now time going this way, and at each time I find the marginal outer trap surface. And I stack them all up, and I form a cylinder. So it's a three-dimensional surface here of topology S2 cross R. And this is what is called a marginally trapped tube. Okay, so it's a tube consisting of cross sections, which are marginally trapped surfaces. So now, in a given black hole spacetime, there'll be many such tubes that exist. And a particular foliation that you choose will select one of these tubes for you. Nevertheless, this object by itself is a covariant thing that exists in your spacetime. You can analyze it in its own right. It's just that in a particular simulation or in a particular situation, your gauge condition might need you to find only one of these. But still, this is a completely valid geometric object in its own right.
Is the trap surface independent of coordinates?
It's independent of coordinate, but well.
After you fix the coordinates, it's independent.
Well, no. I wouldn't phrase it that way. So if I have a sphere, right? If I have a sphere, I can define the null normals completely independent of coordinates. And I can define its expansion independent of coordinates. Exactly. So that's what I'm trying to explain. So if I have a sphere, so if I have a sphere, which is a marginally trapped surface, its null normals are completely coordinate independent. They are just normals to the surface, right? And the expansions are also coordinate independent. So therefore, the whole concept of trapped surface is coordinate independent.
Okay.
Well, apparent horizon refers in the definition itself to a spatial slice, so in that sense it isn't. But what I'm saying is a marginally outer trapped surface that is independent of coordinates.
So you're saying that if I choose to use a different foliation and do the same exercise, I end up with the same?
No, you won't end up with the same one. No.
That's what I was saying. Yeah.
You wouldn't. But it'll be a different tree surface, not this same one.
Right.
Wait, but you'd end up with the same tube.
No, it's a different tube.
Different tube.
I mean, it is possible to take time slices of a black hole that don't give you an apparent horizon, right?
Yeah, that's not really so important. So what happens in that situation is that so that's a sort of infamous example by Bob Vault. So what happens is that if I have if I were to slice this space-time in a very strange way, which is angle-dependent, and for some angles I get very close to singularity, and for some angles I'm outside. So then on that surface, you don't, strictly speaking, have a marginally trapped surface. On the other hand, whatever surface you choose will intersect this whole null surface in a sphere, and the expansion of that will be zero. It's just that for the ingoing expansion will not be negative everywhere. So we can get into details about this endlessly, but I want to get to the main topic that I want to talk about here. So I'm going to define now three types of these marginal trap tubes. The first is what I call a dynamical horizon, which is space-like, and which has the expansion of the ingoing one to be negative. Isolated, that is null, and there's no restriction on theta n. And the time-like situation in which you'll actually see in practice, which is not space-like, but in fact it is it's time-like. So the first thing is, why should this be space-like? And that is in fact the mathematical theorem that I was talking about. So first of all is that numerically you observe that if you find a marginal trap surface, it evolves smoothly in time, okay? There's no situation that I know of where you have a numerical evolution and at some point, for no reason, the surface exists at one time and just disappears out of the blue at the next time step. I've never, ever seen that.
But you just showed the opposite, that there wasn't one and suddenly appeared. I mean, in the Vadia case, there wasn't any marginal trap surface and then suddenly appeared.
Oh, they are. So what do you mean?
I mean, there's nothing and then suddenly you eat it, right?
I mean, we'll talk about how it depends on how you slice the space-time and stuff like that. But the theorem is that once you have such a surface, it cannot disappear.
Just. That's what you're saying. Yeah.
And the condition you need in this theorem to make sure that it evolves smoothly is the stability condition, which means that if you deform it outwards, then it has to become untrapped. Okay. So. And again, we could go into details about this, but the important point is that the time evolution of marginally outer trapped surfaces is smooth as far as we can tell. Okay. And I'm not going to talk about this because I'm running out of time. But I do want to mention one thing, which is that if, again, going back to this example here, so now the area of this, as we'll see, will increase in time. Okay, and that is because there's flux of stuff falling into this tree surface. It is a remarkable fact that now you might imagine that, well, there's a little pencil of light that falls in here, so only that little portion is space-like, the rest is null. That cannot happen. If I have infalling flux at even at one small region here, the whole cross-section is space-like. The whole surface grows in a space-like direction. And the reason for that is the elliptic nature of the problem here. So it's not a local thing, it's an elliptic thing that refers to the whole surface. Okay? And this is in fact what we will see in the precise simulation that I'll talk about in a minute. So now we have defined sort of these objects here. Can we assign mass and spin to them? Yes, we can. So the way you do it is standard in GR. So in other words, you take your space-time which has inner boundaries, which are given by these three surfaces. And then you do Hamilton analysis, and you define then mass and spin as generators of symmetries. And this is what you end up with here. So let me explain what this refers to here. If I have this situation here in which I have a spatial a space-like surface, the extrinsic curvature for that, let's call it K, and let's call the three metric on this to be H. And then I have some symmetry vector here, let's call it phi. Then the spin for this black hole is given by this surface integral, which is K times the unit normal, that's this R here. So it's a surface integral over the two sphere, and this gives you the spin of the black hole. Okay? And given the spin and given the area from which I can get a radius, the mass is given by the usual Christodoulou formula relating the mass with the area and the spin. Okay? So this is not an assumption, it's a calculation in actual GR, which tells you that this is a sensible definition of mass and spin for these objects.
So what is RS here?
This is the area radius, so this is simply area upon 4 pi square root.
It's extrinsic curvature
to be certain. Ignored any possible complexes.
Yeah, it's completely classical. So everything here is classical in this talk.
So if you only upon the physics, then the whole theorem is not applied.
Absolutely. So, absolutely. So here I'm assuming it's classical GR. Everything is standard, and you know nothing. These are large classical black holes. So,
Hawking radiation is based on quantum physics.
Yes, but here I'm assuming it's all classical. So this is in standard classical GR. All of this. And also you can show that you can do all of black hole thermodynamics in the setup, but again, I'm not going to talk about that in this talk. One more thing that we will need are what I'll call horizon multiple moment. That's going to be critical for us to see the deviation of these horizons from the final curve geometry. And here I want to again motivate this in the following way. If I have a distribution of mass or charge or different currents, then it's extremely useful to decompose them into spherical harmonics. Scalar field, I'll decompose them down to these YLMs. If I have a vector or tensor fields, I'll use derivatives of these YLMs. The question now is, for a black hole horizon, I want to define multiple moments. Okay. Again, you have the usual problem in GR, what theta phi should I use on the horizon? So I can choose any theta phi I like, any coordinates on the sphere, and I can use spherical harmonics in these coordinates. But no one tells me these are the right coordinates to use. I could use a different set of theta and phi. I would get different YLMs and different decomposition entirely and different set of multiple moments. Which of these are the right ones? Okay? And this is a fundamental problem. Okay? There is one situation in which this makes sense, in which you have an axial symmetry on the horizon. In this case, you choose a phi coordinate as the affine parameter along the symmetry vector, and you're assuming this has closed orbit and vanished the two points on the sphere, which are going to be the poles. And then you can do a little exercise and then show that, in fact, you can define the other coordinate, the theta coordinate, orthogonal to the phi coordinate, and you can write the metric on the sphere in this form, which is radius squared times this combination here. Important is that this F inverse of zeta in F of zeta, the volume element does not depend on the F.
So before assuming axial symmetry, phi was just what was phi when you wrote the formula for the angular momentum?
That should be an axial symmetry.
Oh.
But it should be, in fact, it's too strong. It should be a divergence-free vector field. It works for that. Right, so in this situation, then the claim is that you do have sort of invariant coordinates on the sphere, and then the point is to use the YLMs in these invariant coordinates. Okay? So given a numerical simulation, the first task is not to use the theta and the phi in principle that you have in the simulation, but to in fact construct these other coordinates and then use those spherical harmonics.
So I guess since you don't have a spherical metric, you could think about the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian.
You could do that, but it doesn't really help. So there's no sort of nice properties of that Laplacian that happens.
Well, it's not that, but it's kind of covariant.
It is covariant, yes. But it only gives you one set of moments, even if you do that. So I'll talk about the mass and the current multiples in a minute.
Okay.
So you could also do that. There could be other ways of doing it as well. But this is, in fact, closer to what we are doing.
Here you're just thinking of like head-on collisions
or not? No. We'll have circular. I'll talk about that in a minute.
In the case of the Laplacian, what would they have to do with the black hole itself, with the horizon? Mm-hmm. In the case of the eigen,
yeah.
What would they have to do with the horizon?
Well, I mean, if you want to decompose things on a surface which is not a sphere, then you just use eigenvalues of the Laplacian.
It's just some self-adjoint operator, so it's got a complete set of bases. Eigenfunctions, you just expand in terms of those. You could do that entirely, and people do that, in fact. The important point now is that I want to now decompose two quantities, which is for the scalar curvature on the sphere, and this combination of the extrinsic curvature, which appears in the angular momentum calculation. So this gives us two set of multiple moments, and then if I have axis symmetry, then only the m equal to 0 moments contribute. And so this then decomposes the geometry into a set of two sets of infinite number, into two sets of numbers. And then important point is that these are different from what you might be more familiar with, are the Giroux-Hansen multiple moments at spatial infinity for a black hole. Okay? And you can compute this explicitly and find the deviations. And it's a non-trivial connection between them is really not clear. So this is what I think of the source multiple moment. These are the field multiple moments. The relation between them is highly non-trivial and not clear at all.
PNs are Legendre
polynomials? PNs are Legendre polynomials, yes. The PN prime is a derivative of PN. So M0 is just the mass by construction because P0 is just 1. And this integral of the scalar curvature is just the invariant. So I just get the mass. That's my construction, but the higher ones are non-trivial. For the J's, the J0 vanishes. Essentially, if you don't have any nut charge, then J0 will vanish. J1 is the case when I have P1 prime, that is 1, then I get the angular momentum. J2, J3, and are the higher multiple moments. All right, so now the actual work that I want to talk about, which is now the initial configuration. It's going to be two black holes very close to each other doing a short orbit before it merges. So we could have done something different, which is a long in spiral phase and the merger and everything. That's fine, but our goal is here to study the final black hole that is formed and see how it reaches equilibrium. So this is good enough for our purposes.
So can I ask, you mentioned you want to have axis symmetry, but then this doesn't have axis symmetry.
It doesn't. In fact, that is a weak point of the whole thing, so I'll talk about that towards the end. So there's, I'll mention. So there are methods to find sort of axial symmetry vectors, approximate symmetries on horizons. So you could use that. But the results really don't change all that much if you use those methods.
So are these horizon multiple moments observable? Like, does it generate any radiative signature?
We'll talk about that later. So the first thing, well, maybe just a preview of that. The first thing is that all of these surfaces are behind the event horizon. So nothing that they do can causally affect anything that happens outside. So in that sense, you cannot take the quadrupole moment here and say, oh, the waveform must be a quadrupole moment generated by that particular moment. So that you should not do. Okay? But there's a sense in which there's a correlation between what happens at infinity and what happens at the horizon. That I'll talk about in more detail later. So in this configuration, we have arbitrary starting point that's roughly 3/4 of an orbit before the common horizon forms. And then the horizon forms in our coordinate time in the simulation at 18.6 is m, where m is essentially the ADM mass of the whole space, and that is a constant. It's not quite, but OK, that for our purposes, you can just think of like the ADM mass. At this time, I have a common horizon that's formed. Before this time, I just have the two individual horizons that exist. Okay? this horizon that forms bifurcates into inner and outer one. I'll show you pictures of all of this in a minute. And then we'll look at the fate of what happens to the outer one in the rest of the talk. So that's a picture, sort of different snapshots of time. This is any time before this, well, it's not quite, let's say, t equal to 15, I would just see the two blue horizons just orbiting each other. Okay. At a time of roughly 18.6, I get the outer horizon that forms, and at this time, that bifurcates into two, an inner one and an outer one. Okay. And this continues at a little later time. The inner one gets more and more deformed. It sort of hugs these individual ones very, very close, and the outer one becomes more and more symmetric as you go on. A little later, the same thing happens here. So the inner one becomes even more deformed, and the outer one then becomes more and more spherical as you go on. And at some point, and this, you know, this is a technical thing about how we locate horizons, this one becomes so deformed that we actually cannot track it numerically in our simulation. A little bit after this, in our coordinates that we are using, these inner ones are so small that, again, we can't resolve it either. So a little bit later than this, I just have the, what we can track is only the outer common horizon.
So should you expect to see the inner, the Kerr inner horizon as well?
No, this is not the Kerr inner horizon at all. So this is a different thing altogether. So the way to think about this might be, again, if I go back to Vaidya, in this picture here. So imagine now I slice this space-time. Think of the different slices here. Okay. So at some point, I'll have a slice that just touches this point here and then goes to infinity. So that is the point where I see a common horizon form.
I understand that, but then, so we know there is a Kerr inner horizon, right? So this is, of course, a spherical symmetry. So should that show up somewhere?
No. So what is real is not the entire Kerr spacetime, but just the exterior part of the Kerr spacetime. So the inner part of it is really hypothetical, so it's not relevant for our purposes.
So basically, at some point, it's like basically the numerics cut out the possibility of tracking such that again, there's the resolution. I mean, to get the horizon development. Yeah, it's just like the differences between like different points are like negligible.
Exactly. So if we wished, we could sort of, you know, put more numerical resources into what happens here and then look at exactly how these individual ones behave. But we don't do that in practice.
What is the shape of, like, first moment where the inner horizons are connected?
It's very close to here. So if you just think about it, like, you know, like this surface here. So this is close enough to that. So just imagine it more smoothed out, something like this. But that's what it would be like, more or less.
But like in like arbitrary pre-forming times, like what is the first like connected form, shape of connected to inner horizons? Because here they're already like connected into single objects, yeah?
Right, so if you look at time much before this, I would just have the two blue horizons, there would be nothing else.
Okay, so the green one is already presumed to not a result ever of like merging two inners, but like it's apparently calculated as like the core.
Exactly, yes. What happens is that when, so I have two horizons, when they get close to each other, a common horizon appears. And that bifurcates into two. So it's not that these go into the inner ones or something, no.
Are there techniques to calculate like in going to inner horizons into like ongoing outgoing, you know. I mean, like in the sense that, like, thinking of this as a sense of space-time collision or something. Yeah. Other techniques to connect, like, independent, like, shape descriptions of, like, inner horizons before collision, like, single form that would be, like, numerically valid after a collision.
Yeah, but I mean, they just don't exist at some earlier time, right? They just come into existence only at a given time in our simulation. So before, much before this, these just don't exist. Just these two blue ones that are just orbiting each other. Right, and then, so now as you'll imagine, given these different sequences of the surface, you can stack them up, form a three, a smooth three manifold, and then you can compute various geometric quantities for these. This is just what I said earlier about the other horizons. The important point is the areas, first of all. So this here, let me explain this slowly. So this here represents some of the areas of the two individual horizons. Okay? And that is basically a constant, which means that the two individual horizons are essentially null surfaces, and they behave exactly as you might expect. At this point, which is exactly when the common horizon forms, this is then the outer portion, this is the inner portion. Okay? That bifurcates into two, the outer one increases in area, the inner one decreases in area. So this already tells you that, in fact, this bifurcation is actually quite smooth. It's just a smooth surface, which I'm slicing. And thereby, that leads to this inner and the outer horizon in that sense.
So the outer horizon, you're also characterizing as a trapped surface.
Yes, these are all trapped surfaces, marginally trapped surfaces.
And the inner horizon, so because if that's the marginally trapped surface, how do you keep track of what's inside as another marginally trapped surface?
They're all marginal trap surfaces. It's just that,
I guess some are outer trap, maybe that's what.
No, they're all complete. So, I'll explain in a minute. So the, all of these surfaces satisfy the condition that the expansion outgoing is zero.
But you put a marginally.
So these are marginally outer trap surfaces. The inner expansion does not have to be negative for all of these. Okay. So I should speed up a bit. So this, if you like, is a cartoon of what I believe the dynamics is. So these are the two individual horizons. They're going to spiral towards each other. At some point, they'll merge. At this point, I have a common horizon that forms that gives you a smooth surface that just bifurcates in inner and outer. And at some point here, something will happen which we don't know. Somehow all of these have to get together and hopefully form a smooth surface at the end of the day.
Why are you making a cartoon picture when you can make a real picture?
Yeah, we're just too lazy. It's not so easy to make the real picture so nice because, first of all, the scale, we tried it actually. The scale of this would be really, really too small. So hopefully at some point I have enough expertise in doing these visualizations that will make something like that. But at the moment, this is beyond our numerical skills, let's say.
What is the outside observer seeing about all this, if anything?
Nothing. That doesn't see any of this.
Yeah, so none of these will be visible to the outside observer, yes. None of this is visible.
Okay. Right. Time to form. Lies to all the horizons.
No, not to these. These form in a finite time. There's nothing infinite about them. It depends. I'll have a space-time, more space-time diagram for in a minute. But they do form, but they're inside the event horizon. If that's what you're asking.
So I'm always going to be outside the black hole.
Indeed, yes. Yes.
I'm not interested in what was on inside.
Well, that's your choice. I mean, that's completely fine. I mean, I think you can make the choice, and it's a fair choice.
Well, it's the only choice I have.
No.
Well, not quite. So.
What? Jumping to the black hole.
Physical observer outside. Each of them has a horizon which takes an infinite amount of time to.
Well, the infinite time is a particular slicing that you're choosing, but I mean, you could choose different slicing whether it's not infinite time. So, but it is true that these are all inside the event horizon, so it's not visible to an outside observer. That is completely true. But I'll talk in the end a little bit more about correlation between what you see in infinity and what you see inside. So maybe that is one way you might like it a bit more, but it doesn't affect the fact that you would not see it in practice. Yes, that's true. Yes, I agree with you, yes. All right. So one interesting fact is that the outer horizon, in fact, does not have the ingoing expansion negative everywhere. And so it's not completely trapped. But the average is, in fact, always negative. And that is good enough for all the results that I mentioned to work. Okay? And the outer horizon is, in fact, space-like, as you might expect. The inner horizon is initially space-like by continuity, just because it's a bifurcation from the outer one. But soon it becomes time-like. Okay? And the inner, the individual horizons remain null as far as we can try.
I'm very confused with that. I think the outer horizon does not have the time negative?
No, it doesn't, in fact. It's a bit surprised to me as well. Yeah.
So it's not actually a trapped surface then?
Well, it's a well, again, it depends on definitions. So marginally outer trap surface just requires theta L to be zero.
But the trap usually it means that you want to keep things in.
Yeah, so it's not a marginally trapped surface in that sense. It keeps things in because it is space-like. In other words, if I have a space-like surface, once you fall in, which is you're to the future of it, you can't come back out. So the keeping in or out depends on space-like nature of the surface.
So there are actually like foliations which one can get some data about inner horizons before the round 31 after.
You could do that, yes. That could happen, yeah.
Oh, this is cool.
Yeah.
This is actually cool.
No, wait, I don't understand. Oh, I don't understand. You said it's space-like, so that's a statement that is independent of the foliation.
Indeed, yes. It is independent of foliation. But I think what you're asking is different foliation of space-time, which intersects only some part of this space-like surface. So that you could do, yes.
Nice.
Right. So now the physical quantities here. So the weakest point of all this analysis is the axial killing vector. Okay. When the black hole is first formed, it is not axisymmetric by far. Okay. So there are sort of more sophisticated ways of dealing with this. But for now, in this work, we just take the phi direction to be the symmetry vector. This is sort of justified because we have reflection symmetry in our problem. So the setup, everything is reflection symmetric. So if I have a slice of the equator, if I reflect around that, I get the same stuff below the equator as I do above the equator. So whatever I have curves of constant theta, those should be the same as the curve of d by d phi. But still, it doesn't mean does not mean that there is a symmetry vector. Okay? Just a choice that we're making right now, and this has to be improved in the future.
Why do you say that the curve A is 0.68 as expected? Why is that expected?
It's expected by other simulations which started off at two black holes. It's other simulations. So essentially, it's now a fundamental result in GR that if I have two non-spinning black holes that merge, the final black hole has a curve parameter of 0.68. And this is consistent with that entirely.
This may not be true. Measured spins.
It is the same as the measured spins.
So this is the measured spin of the final black hole.
For merging two non-spinning black holes.
Yeah.
There's not an issue about the size.
But actually, I mean, the measurements are based on GR simulation, so I suppose it's a pathology that will be.
So it depends how you do this. So there's two ways of doing it. What I talked about in the beginning, which is just look at the final part of the waveform,
right,
and base your measurement just on that, then it's not a tautology. So then you're looking at a waveform that is just for the final black hole. You measure spin from that. That is an independent measurement. But if you do sort of the whole waveform, and you just measure the initial parameters, and sort of this is something that you fit from that, then it's a tautology, as you said. Okay. Right. And the mass computed from the spin and the area decreases increases monotonically. So there's no sort of short period of super radiance or energy extraction. It just always increases and reaches a final asymptotic value. So now the multiple moments, which is really the interesting thing for our purposes. So now we can track them and see how they evolve in time for the outer horizon that is formed. And then I want to see how, at what rate, I reach a Kerr solution at the end. Okay. So at the crudest level, I just take the moments, I plot them as a function of time. This is what you get. This is the second mass multiple, M4, M6, M8. Again, these are the spin moment, J3, J5, J7. Right?
Sorry, can you go back for a second?
Yep.
The mass you have as the horizon mass. So how much does it change? It's like 4%.
Yeah, so this is like, let's say 0.94. This is about 0.979, well, 0.98, let's say. Yeah, so it's
4%, 5%.
Yeah.
That's the mass, I guess you can interpret that as energy that goes into the horizon.
Exactly.
Which is accurate, I guess, the same as energy that goes out to gravity channel. That's also 5%, I think, fair enough.
It's roughly similar, yes. So I'll talk about the fluxes in a moment, but yeah, this is, you can get an estimate of that. So in fact, if you do imagine there's sort of other structure at the horizon that is happening, so then this is sort of what you're expecting from GR that is falling into the black hole. It has to come back out again. Then, you know, this is the stuff that could possibly come out again. All right, so these are the moments that we measure. If you go beyond this, then you need more angular resolution that we don't have. So even for the highest M8 and J7, it's not super accurate, as we'll see in a minute. So now let's look at this in a little bit more detail. This is the crudest level, functions of time, and see then and what we get. So let's do the following. At any given time, I have the mass and the spin, right? Given the mass and the spin, if this were a curved black hole, I could compute all the higher moments independently. Okay? So what I can do is take the ratio of what I actually measure and what we expect if it were curved. So I can take, for example, M2, take the ratio at a given time t. At that time t, have a given mass and a spin. And given that mass and spin, I can find the curve value for M2, for example. And I can take the ratio of these two guys.
I guess you're subtracting 1 from it. And you go to 0? Or no, this 1 is...
It'll go to 1.
Oh, yeah, I see. That's very close.
I should have a line here. So this is...
Have 1 there, too.
This is exactly 1, yeah.
Nice.
Or maybe I should subtract 1 from it. That would be easier.
Except for M8, I don't know.
Exactly. So M8 and J7 do not approach. And that is a numerical problem because the numerical resolution that we have is at the edge of what we can do for M8 and J7. Okay? But for the ones that we're confident, we can really measure them, and they really go to 1 quite clearly. The same for the spin moments here. So now let's look at the time dependence in a little bit more detail. So the first question is, what is the fall of other moments as they approach curve? At very late times, if you're aware of Richard Price's calculations back, I guess, in the 80s or 70s, you expect power law decays at very, very late times. But before that, what I would expect is the immediate post-merger phase, I have a sharp fall off, and then I have the quasi-normal ringing, that is, again, exponential decay. So what I would expect is some combination of exponential decays at the earlier times. Okay? And let's see if that is true or not. So this is now the same plot as I had, except it's on a logarithmic scale, and I've subtracted off values to make them all positive. Okay? And what you see is this is when the horizon forms. You see a very sharp fall off at the earlier times. At about 10m after the merger, 27, the horizon forms at about 18 or thereabouts. So roughly at 10m after the merger, which is what the other analysis found, is when you get a transition from the steep fall off to a more shallower fall off. Yeah. And
what is that power? It's
the power of 10.
No, you said it's the power of alpha. You say this is the
parallel
fall off.
No, it's exponential fall off.
This is still
a parallel. I'm just plotting the whole thing on a logarithmic scale.
You're right.
Okay.
So you go from one exponential to another exponential.
Exactly. So that's exactly what we'll do in a minute. And you see exactly the same behavior also for the spin moments here. So this, I guess, is the one new quantitative result that you get from this analysis, which are the different fall off rates before and after this transition point. Okay?
Are there any other specific characteristics of this, some effect at this point?
Sorry, I didn't follow that. Say it again.
In this point in time, it does happen also some other, there is some other interesting characteristic.
Oh, you mean at this time here?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I don't really know. So this is the first time this was noticed here. And we use these multiple moments to find this transition point. I don't know if there's anything else that you could, any diagnostic you could think of apart from this.
Okay, so one special moment, so what happened?
Yeah, so I don't know the true answer to this. What I conjecture is that at any given time, you have fall-offs at different, a sum of different exponentials. So it's e to the minus alpha 1t plus e to the minus alpha 2t and so on. At any given time, one of them dominates. Once it falls off sharply, then the other one dominates. And that's then the other one here. So if you just have a combination of these exponentials, then you get this exactly this behavior,
so
as you see here.
What you're saying is there are two components. One component falls off at some, let's say, surface gravity. The other component is quasi-normal. So.
Exactly, yes.
Which one is the quasi-normal?
So I'll give you values in a minute. So this is the quasi-normal frequency that matches well with this fall-off here, but not with this one.
How does this 27 depend on the initial separation for your black hole? Any argument on this? Or?
It doesn't really depend. So I think this transition is a property of the final black hole, really. So it doesn't seem to depend so much on the initial configuration that you start off with.
But so this is just saying that you're somehow giving a larger initial perturbation to the faster decay time.
That's what it is, basically, yes.
Did you try to connect these, like the faster decay times to some other, like higher order quasi-normal or something like that?
Yeah, so I tried that for a while. I didn't really reach any conclusive answer on that question. So it's possibly true, but I don't know which one it is. So, well, if you want, these are the values, okay? So you can play with these values till end of your day. What is true is that these values here are very, very close to twice the damping time for the fundamental mode.
In which sense was the J7 not trustworthy, the simulation? Because,
yeah, so it works fine here. It's at a very late time. So I've cheated here, okay? So I've subtracted off a value so to make them all positive. Because if you look earlier, you'll see they're not all positive, okay? So this is the sort of zoom in, and you'll see some are negative. Some become, they oscillate, so they become negative at some short portions. So to get this plot here, you got to sort of make them, I want to take a logarithm, so it needs to be positive what I do. So I got to sort of shift them up and down to make them sort of all positive. And that shift then depends on the final asymptotic value, which is not accurate. But the behavior, apart from that, for this, even if you don't trust it, just look at then these others, and that's get the same behavior.
So you said the decay rate is twice the other one?
Yeah, so this is, well, you could, again, you could do this game here, right? So you can compare sort of the decay rate before and after.
Right.
And now I'm not willing to sort of say anything conclusive on this point here. But what is true is that these decay rates are twice the values of the fundamental quasi-normal mode decay rate.
Twice,
yes.
After 27.
You're
saying you don't have the fundamental
quasi-normal. We are squaring things, so it's like squaring something. So that's why you get the power of 2, factor of 2.
Are you squaring things?
It is basically that. So multiple moments are sort of depend on the flux, so that is squared of the incoming radiation, so that's why. And again, this one again you might say is not right for that. But again, it is funny. So I mean, this is M2 is the one that we measure very well. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the M2 has these huge oscillations. This makes it hard to fit a straight line to this to make a trend from here. Okay. So again, I think this is something for future work. You can also sort of estimate the frequency. So just look at the different peaks and troughs and see the separation in time, and that is consistent. So you get again twice the frequency of the fundamental quasi-normal mode. Okay. So this is again just repeating what I said, which is that are these features sort of anything fundamental or not? So that we need more work for that. There's just one last thing I want to talk about. Can I take 5 more minutes? So I said that for event horizons, you cannot in principle have an equation for the flux in all generality. Okay. because it grows in flat space where everyone agrees there can be no flux or stuff falling into the black hole. For the dynamical case, however, you can do this in GR, and you can obtain an exact flux formula, which depends on the shear of the ingoing of the outgoing null normal. And there's an extra correction term, which I'm not going to talk about here, but there's a lot of interesting things about it. But the important point is that this is an exact result in GR for the infalling flux into one of these marginally trapped tubes. Okay? And then you can look at how this compares with the outgoing flux at to infinity. Okay? So this, first of all, let me just show you the shear at two different times on the horizon. Okay? This is phi, that is theta, and I'm plotting for you here the sigma square of the shear at t equal to 19, at t equal to 25 at late times. So it's exactly, well, almost, not exactly almost, a quadrupolar pattern. So this is maximum at the poles, it's minimum at two 90-degree lines on the equator. So this is exactly what you expect from a quadrupole radiation falling into the black hole. Okay? And this decreases if I go from early times to late times, this falls off as you would expect. Okay? And then you look, try to now convince yourself that this actually makes some sense in exactly in the question that you asked about the observability. So the main point here is that the picture I have is that I have some stuff happening outside the black hole horizon. So imagine that if I have a black hole with some effective potential, there's a peak of the potential outside the black hole, and there's stuff which is trapped between the horizon and the peak of the potential outside the black hole. And this stuff is going to fall into the black hole. There's other stuff that's going to escape out to infinity. Okay? But whatever it is, if I'm given initial data here, that determines everything to the future. So the initial data here, if it contains all these nonlinearities, determines what falls into the black hole, what goes out to infinity, and exactly how the black hole is going to settle down to infinity at late times. And since this is nonlinear theory, the ingoing outgoing modes are going to be coupled to each other. So therefore, it's not surprising that we expect correlation between what falls into the black hole and what goes out to infinity. Okay? So it's not observable. So anything happening here is behind the event horizon, so that you cannot see here, but still, what you see here has a counterpart in what happens here.
Of course, the point is, if it takes an infinite amount of time to produce the event horizon, it takes an infinite amount of knowledge. It takes the history of the universe to know the initial.
Okay, the infinite amount of time is a question of slicing, okay? So I can choose to slice in this way, where it's a completely finite time in which these horizons form. Okay? If you accept a frozen picture of the star, then yes, it's infinite time, yes. But that's an artifact of your slicing.
You need the history of the universe to know the initial particles.
That is true, yes. That is true, yeah. But the point is, everything is determined by the initial data that you prescribe.
On the other hand, we still see gravitational wave.
Indeed. And the reason for that is that what's producing it, it's not the black hole itself, it's stuff happening outside the black hole.
Yes. That's the amazing thing about relativity.
Indeed, and everything, exactly, and stuff happening here knows precisely, so the black hole here is highly distorted, okay, at this initial time, but the stuff here knows precisely what to send into the black hole to make the all these distortions go away at late times.
So can I? So there'd be a point that from the previous study whether there's correlation between the wave patterns and the apparent horizon and infinity, right?
I think
it wasn't quite clear.
So this is trying to motivate the correlations, why they would exist.
But yeah, I couldn't quite see the correlation.
Yeah, so now this is the correlation.
But you had the angular correlation and this is the time correlation.
Exactly, angular is easy because they're both quadrupolar. I haven't shown the outgoing radiation because that is quadrupolar, right?
Okay, that's fine, okay.
So, and really it is... There's no reason to show that really in this picture. But what is good to show is the time dependence of the infalling and the outgoing flux. So all I've done here, really this is not complex data analysis, right? I mean, I could sort of do overlaps and I'm blue in the face, doesn't matter. So I got a flux going inwards as a function of time, averaged over the whole horizon. So that is this green line here. The purple one is the outgoing flux at a very large distance from the black hole. I've just shifted them in time to make the peaks align with each other. That's all, nothing more than that. No stretching, nothing.
And what time do you use here?
This is the time relevant for the outgoing. It doesn't matter. So this time is really is relative time. So I've shifted the two functions of time so that the peaks coincide.
No, but I'm saying there is no, this is the foliation dependent.
Exactly. So I'll come to that in a minute. So there was no, before I did this plot, there was no reason to expect the two things to agree so well with each other. Imagine that I have something happening at the horizon, something happening far away. In the simulation, I have different gauge conditions at the horizon at stuff happening far away. So different rates of time evolution, different, you know, it's all different. There's no reason to expect this to happen in the simulation that we are working with.
Yeah, the thing I find very puzzling about is that, you remember I asked you about how much mass changed, and you said it was 5%?
Uh-huh.
We know 5% of mass also changes, goes into gravitational waves. But it looks like here, if I integrate this...
I'm not sure. So this purple line has a part before this as well.
Oh.
That's a part before the peak.
Right.
So I've not displayed that for you. So you would have to add that to the, if you want to find that total.
Make it even bigger. So it looks like then the integrated outgoing flux.
The outgoing flux is down by a factor of 10.
So outgoing flux is higher, yes.
So this says that there is much more outgoing energy than if I integrate this than incoming energy.
No. So I've taken out the one upon. I have to not check again. So it depends which sphere you integrate on. So I've taken out the 1 upon r here, possibly, so I got to check on that. But they should be roughly similar to each other. I should stop here at this point. So the main takeaway from this talk is that, you know, the quantitative number you want is that roughly 10m after the common horizon is formed, something happens to change, something seems to change. The transition from a fall-off rate to a different fall-off rate. So now the question is this a generic feature of black hole mergers, or perhaps only for some specific initial data that we don't know? And again, you know, all the gauge condition questions are completely valid, so we need further study to see if this is true. Thank you. Normally there is not. No. So that's a highly non-trivial thing. So the flux I defined here, this is a local expression. No, it's not coordinate dependent. It's completely coordinate independent. So the shears are coordinate independent, and they're local quantities here. And this is non-trivial. I mean, this is not something that you take for granted. So this only happens for these trapped surfaces. It doesn't happen for other spheres I would consider. So this, I claim, is a result in exact GR telling you exactly how a black hole grows with local flux falling into it.
This has always been an issue with gravitation.
No, but this is one case where I claim that you can show precisely, exactly in GR, that the infalling flux into these trapped surfaces, that is well-defined. It is not true for random surfaces or for other kinds of things, as far as I know. But it is specifically true for these kinds of surfaces.
Generally, the flux is not local.
It's not generally, you're right, it's not local in general, but for this specific situation, it is.
So these are conservation laws that can tell me how these multiple moments change given some kind of flux.
Exactly, you can get those laws as well, yeah.
Okay.
So
we're
not, can you go back to the part where you had the ingoing and outgoing flux?
Mm-hmm.
So, just looking, so there's two different scales for them, right?
Yeah, so you're right, yes. You're entirely right. So the incoming flux has this scale here. So this might answer your question. So the incoming flux has this scale here, but it's over a smaller radius.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
That makes sense.
So the outgoing flux is this scale here, but it's a much larger radius.
Right, so I shouldn't take that.
So don't take the actual scale of this. It just, so GNUplot has decided to put them, join them up here, but that means a different scale altogether here. This is the flux average over the sphere, yes.
It's average or it's the total?
It's got to be, no, it's got to be similar. So it's got to be just the sum. It's got to be just the integrated flux.
Okay, but so there's much less outgoing flux?
No, no, sorry. It's got to be the average flux, yes. It's the average.
Okay.
So I got to multiply by the area, so then I would get similar scales of numbers.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just one question. In the last conclusions, you said you didn't expect this because there are very different gauge conditions.
Yeah.
And have you tried changing the gauge conditions?
It's not as trivial as you might think to, in the simulation, to change the condition and redo the simulation again. So we're looking into what makes, there's something special about the condition that we are using. This is from experience from the simulation for many, many years. The people doing the simulation settled on a gauge condition that seems to work, that is well-behaved at the black hole, well-behaved in the wave zone, and this is exactly what we're using here.
What is that?
So that is roughly saying that the trace of the extrinsic curvature of the spatial slice is roughly constant, or small enough. So somehow that is a condition that seems to make these fluxes agree with each other. I don't know the reason for that, really.
But that's not what everybody uses. Does it use the same?
So that's a harmonic gauge condition, basically. So that's also connected to this trace of the extrinsic curvature.
Oh, okay. You're saying everybody uses the same gauge condition?
It's not the same, but they're similar.
Right.
They're similar, is what I would say.
Right. But it's still, it would be interesting to see the difference. Mm-hmm. If there are any.
No other questions? That's, thanks for your
good. Thank you.